The Tom Woods Show, episode 1871.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Our old friend John Tamney from RealClearMarkets.com is back with us today, and he's got a brand new book, When Politicians Panicked, The New Coronavirus, Expert Opinion, and a Tragic Lapse of Reason. Now, this book is quite different from the book we talked about last week or the week before with Steve Dace, his book, Fauci and Bargain. That's a more straightforward, here's what they told us, here's what really happened kind of book. This book focuses much, much more on the economic ramifications of everything that's happened. So I think they complement each other quite nicely. So I'm glad to really be able to dig into this with John. So John, welcome back.
Hey, great to be back, Tom. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for writing this book so I didn't have to, doggone it. I was tempted to write a book having something to do with all this, and it's just the thought of it exhausted me, actually, you know? And then I saw that friends of mine were actually gearing up to release books, and I thought, well, they're going to probably write what I would have written, and so that requires a lot less effort on my part, so I'll let them do it. So I'm glad you did. So first of all, it's really important to get a counter-narrative out there because, as we all know from the past, whether it's 2008 or, you know, even something like the Great Depression and the New Deal, once the official version of events is solidified in people's minds, it's very, very difficult to dislodge. And we're still fluid enough in the current circumstances that an alternative point of view may still have a fighting chance. So I'm really glad you did this. Now, your book places a lot of emphasis on the economic side of things. It's not so much an analysis of should they have imposed this mask mandate at this time in this state and what were the results compared to other states. That's not the kind of book you've written. What is the kind of book you've written?
Yeah, no, I wrote this one on purpose. And let me first say what you're talking about in terms of narrative is crucial. And that's why I hope you still write a book, because you're right. The 1930s are still being misreported. 2008 is still being misreported. And so it's essential that our side gets these truths out there so that we can have a say in how the history is written. Now, I wrote an economics book because to me, this is an economic story. It's simple as that. Unless we make it an economic story, because that's what it is, history books will say that a virus caused a global economic contraction. No, panicky politicians caused a global economic contraction. And so lots of people will write about whether the virus was a huge health threat, whether some will say it was a very small one. Interesting points of view on both sides. I think the more crucial story to tell is that politicians responding to a virus chose economic desperation as the strategy to fight it. Historians will marvel at the abject stupidity of such an approach.
All right, well, let's get right into that then. There's so much material in this, I want to just laser focus on a few basic things. So right from the beginning, we're faced with a situation in early, I mean, I guess you could date this back to late 2019 because people say the virus was spreading then, but almost nobody was aware of it at that point. So what really matters is when it came into the public consciousness in early 2020, particularly, I mean, I remember watching the news in February wondering when is this going to hit the U.S. and what effect is it going to have? But March is, of course, when the you-know-what really hit the fan. Now, you're saying that not because the virus, you know, doesn't kill people, it does kill some people, but you're saying that there was no need for government panic and lockdowns and all this micromanaging of businesses and stuff like that, because why? What would have happened in the absence of that?
Well, in the absence of that, there was still going to be a response. Implicit in this idea that we didn't want government to react and bite its nails and politicians to have hissy fits is that we didn't think that the American people or people around the world shouldn't take precautions. Well, I don't know anyone who feels that way. We're just saying that absent government response, people still would have taken precautions. Indeed, it's documented fact that in the red states, you know, the states that don't believe in science, that their people responded most quickly to the virus, precisely because their politicians didn't feel the need to lock down right away. They started making the adjustments on their own. They went out less. They went to restaurants less. They were more careful about crowds. Overseas in Germany, masks sold out before any mandates or any lockdowns were put in place. People don't need a law to avoid what might cause them to get sick or in rare instances die. We all know people who well before this were always washing their hands, who were always afraid to touch doorknobs and door handles. This is the way we are even without a virus spreading. The idea that we weren't going to respond with a virus spreading defies basic common sense.
Okay. And by the way, that is a pretty good reflection of my own behavior in March when I didn't exactly know what we were facing. I was wondering, should I go to that concert? Now, it ended up being postponed, so that decision was taken out of my hands. But my daughter, who was turning 6, had a birthday party coming up. And one parent after another was calling me on the phone saying, well, I think we better just wait and see on this. And at that time, I knew so little about the virus that I thought that was a sensible enough response. I wasn't upset about anything. So yeah, you're right. Everybody was sitting around trying to figure out what ought to be done. And likewise for business. I mean, here's the thing. As you say, the narrative we get all the time now in the headlines is, you know, coronavirus causes all kinds of problems for business, and it's leading us into a recession, and it's doing this. But as you say, it's not the virus so much as it is the government response. So let's talk a little bit about the attempt by the government then, once the damage was done by, you know, basically telling businesses that either they have to close or they can only open at 25% capacity. I mean, some industries, even at 100% capacity, you barely scrape by. They decided they were going to help. The government was going to help. How did the government help, and what kind of good did this do for us?
It just delayed what would have been a much greater recovery. You're familiar with the Benjamin Anderson history of the 1930s. All in our crowd are. And what we know is that government spending, by definition, is basically the layering of central planning on top of central planning. Command and control is what got us into an economic downturn. We weren't calling for major, quote, stimulus as though it would work in February of 2020. But by March, politicians were calling for it. Okay, well, what was the difference? Yeah, by March, businesses were no longer free to operate. Workers were no longer free to work to varying degrees. And so politicians, having wrecked a lot of economic activity with their mandates, then decided to do, as politicians do, to throw money at their errors. And so having foisted command and control, they then extracted $2.9 trillion of wealth created in the private economy to reallocate to businesses, which was the ultimate non sequitur. Businesses didn't need, quote, government aid. They needed to be free to operate again. But since they weren't free, based on politicians threw it at them. And so they logically, this delayed recovery even more. Imagine where we'd be today if politicians had done nothing and that wealth had been left in the private sector so that it could be effectively and intrepidly allocated or pushed toward a higher use.
Now, you say that all they needed to have, I'm just playing devil's advocate here, was their businesses opened again. But the problem was, even in the absence of government coercion, what you had in, well, all of 2020, I mean, long after it was unreasonable to continue to be living in fear about this thing, people were living in fear. So even if they did open their businesses, a huge chunk of their customer base, or at least a very significant one, was just not going to be seen again. And so they still would need some kind of outside government stimulus to handle that problem.
To be clear, there's no doubt that Americans reacted in a way that was very fearful, as you say. We know this. We know that in the red states, again, the science-denying states, that people stopped going to restaurants as much. They stopped going out as much, all those things. But in a free economy, that would have just set the stage for a major rebound. For one thing, when we consume less, our savings don't just go off and fall asleep. They serve as rocket fuel for businesses that are in search of capital. So the reduced consumption is going to build the capital base, after which it's got to be stressed that no business ever, ever, ever runs out of money. What they run out of is investor trust, investor belief in the future. As I point out in the book, Amazon was Amazon.org for years. It just couldn't make profits. Yet investors stuck around because they saw a better future. And the same idea would have applied here. No doubt some businesses were going to go under in the spring of 2020. That's true no matter what. Any year in an economy as dynamic as ours, the team picture is constantly changing. But businesses that suddenly experienced a big drop off in customers what could have much more credibly gone to investors and lenders and all sorts of financial sources and said, look, this is a near-term thing. People are scared. They could have gone into the market for loans, but with government having shut things down and having made clear that any business that presumed to start operating would have electricity shut off, suddenly government made itself the only source of credit in town. No one was going to touch a business that no one had a clue about when government was going to basically take its foot off the proverbial neck. And so the problem, once again, was the government intervention. Absent it, people would have been okay. They could have gone back into the market for capital.
Well, look, I think one of the things fueling it, and I want to blame the government, you know, for everything, but is also, frankly, public ignorance about the economy. I'm frankly surprised we got this far in American history without there being vastly more government intervention, given how little knowledge Americans have and how much propaganda they've been fed. So I think the average person basically thought along these lines. Big business is sitting on a big pile of cash. They'll be fine. You know, that'll see them through. They have a big pile of cash. They're rich and greedy. They have plenty of money to see this through. So yeah, for the sake of safety, we're going to shut them down and they can eat a bit of their seed corn. Small business, okay, they have a tougher time, but then we just need the government to give everybody some kind of regular cash payment to see us through until the crisis passes. So people just think in these cartoonish ways that that's what's going to happen. Big business can just rest on its laurels and use the big pile of cash that they roll around with their sweaty bodies in. And the small businesses, you know, we can just print some money who knows where. They don't even say print the money because they have no idea where the money's coming from. The government will just give them some money to see it through. Hard to fight against a tidal wave like that.
Yes, it's hard, but that's why we do what we do. If we can't win that argument or if we can't convince people of the truth, then we should be doing something else. I think that's an argument we can win simply because let's agree that to some degree what you're saying is true in the sense that if there hadn't been any kind of lockdowns, I think it's a safe bet to say that Disney, a big American business, would have shut down its theme parks. Now, why could it have done that? Because as a big business with a good track record of treating its shareholders well, it could have gone to investors and said, we are going to step aside briefly to see where this virus is going. We don't want to risk our brand on becoming known as a super spreader. Okay, fine. To your exact point, small businesses, let's assume they have less access to capital. So they would have probably said, we can't risk being shut down even for a day. As you alluded earlier, our margins are so razor thin, we've got to be operating at 100% no matter what. Well, good, you need both. The small businesses became businesses in the first place by figuring out the needs of customers in some way. They would have had to evolve. They would have had to innovate to meet the needs of customers who perhaps had been changed, who are perhaps fearful. And in doing this, they would have created crucial information for the Disneys of the world about how to evolve in a new kind of environment. And so you needed, as always, millions of different businesses trying millions of different things rather than forced one size fits all for everyone, simply because it robbed everyone of the information necessary about how to fight this, how to evolve. You have the cruise industry. You're in Florida, this wildly prosperous industry that's still trying to get permission to be back in operation. Don't we want to know what they would have done if they'd been left alone? The ships would be sailing right now and they would have figured out ways to meet the needs of a different customer base. We never even learned.
Yeah, that's a good point. And so instead, what we have is I just saw a headline the other day from Norwegian Cruise Lines. And I'm very sympathetic to the cruise industry. Of course, I hosted a cruise for 4 years and with Bob Murphy. And it was very successful and we loved it. So I'm very sympathetic to the cruise industry. And, you know, they've just hemorrhaged money and they have these gigantic billion-dollar ships that are just sitting there generating nothing, and they're desperate to figure out a way to get back on the water. And so Norwegian is proposing, well, what if we just limit the ship to vaccinated people and we'll just do that? Now, it's not absolutely impossible that completely left on their own, that would have been the private sector solution, but I rather think that it might have been less sledgehammer and more clever and more subtle than that. But I think now they feel like, well, this is the kind of thing that might get Fauci's attention. And that's the most important thing, is to get Fauci on board. That wouldn't have been what a private sector firm would have thought. I think they would have come up with all kinds of possible ways other than alienating at least 20% of their customer base right off the bat. So instead, what we get is, well, we see what the solutions would have been with the government breathing down their necks. Okay, well, I'm not as curious about what that would be, because I kind of know it's going to all be one size fits all.
Yeah, and how very insulting. Again, we're the very entity, the very concept that gave us the DMV and the post office and the passport office suddenly was telling businesses how to operate, what they could do. Well, the very notion of that defies basic common sense. To me, and I think I speak for the both of us, every business is a bit of a miracle. And so imagine what they could have done on their own. Again, I find it arrogant myself, because I've written all these speculations. I wrote it in the book. I write it in op-eds saying, well, you know, if they'd been left free to do what they do, maybe the cruise operators would have done peak pricing. Maybe they would have said for this voyage that maybe they would have controlled, you know, how many people on their ships by bidding up the cost of going on. And if they bid it up to a certain number, they would stop more customers, all sorts of market signals. But that's just me, some nobody. Imagine, as you allude, companies that have billion-dollar ships that are quite literally amusement park, hotels, entertainment centers on the water. They figured out how to grow to meet the customer's needs in staggeringly brilliant ways. Imagine what they could have done if they'd been free to say, hey, look, you love your customers. The last thing you want to do is create a scenario whereby your customers get sick or die. Do what you have to do to stay in operation. I wish we could have seen what they came up with, but of course we can't. They're not allowed to operate to this day.
Hey, folks, let's take a quick minute to thank our sponsor, Blinkist, which is perfect for people like you who thirst for knowledge but have limited time. Blinkist takes thousands of books in dozens of nonfiction categories and drills down to produce 15-minute summaries that you can read or listen to. So you get the meat of the book, you know what the key arguments and points are, and then you'll know, do I want to read this entire book and get into this in more detail? I like Blinkist because if there's some book everybody's talking about, I can get the gist of it on the way to the store. Blinkist allows me to make the most of dead time, such as when I'm driving. And they offer a wide variety of titles. So, for example, you can read From the Horse's Mouth, COVID-19, The Great Reset by Klaus Schwab, but you can also read great libertarian classics like Capitalism and Freedom by Milton Friedman or For a New Liberty by Murray Rothbard. Join the 15 million people who are already using Blinkist to broaden their knowledge. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/woods to start your free 7-day trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/woods to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/woods. Talk to us, because you spend a decent amount of time in the book on it, about Federal Reserve policy through all this.
I can't write a book without talking about that, because the assumption was across the board that the economic rebound or the stock market rebound was rooted in Fed interest rate policy, and I just reject the notion altogether. In truth, what caused the stock market rebound was inequality, and a beautiful inequality. Amazon, at a time when people all around them were losing their heads, Amazon stepped up and hired 500,000 people to meet the needs of a customer base. It took a huge risk. It was very risky for Amazon to do this, because a lot of people thought the economy was going to be in free fall, from which it would never return. And Amazon starts hiring and figuring out ways. Jeff Bezos pushes aside all of his eleemosynary things, all the things he was doing outside of Amazon, to focus on meeting the needs of a very worried customer base. And the stock market rewarded Amazon. Investors rewarded it in a big way. And so to me, the stock market rally, if you took out Amazon, if you took out Apple, if you took out Netflix, all these companies that proved how valuable they were to a global customer base during a very fraught time, a time created by a political class that destroyed so much wealth for other companies, if you take those out, there is no stock market rally. So to pretend, as some do, that the Federal Reserve did this presumes that the Fed not only can plan markets, but it can plan which companies will do particularly well during a stock market run-up. And I just, again, I find the notion laughable.
I like your chapter, Experts Aren't the Answer to Crisis, They Are the Crisis, because there's so much to be said about that. There are genuine experts in this world. There are people who know an awful lot. There are experts on monetary policy. There are experts on anything you can think of. When it comes to things involving public policy, however, the experts are almost never consulted. It's always quacks, or the state tells us who the experts are we need to listen to, and then that becomes a problem. So what are you driving at in that chat?
Well, what I'm driving at is that even the experts whom you and I would trust, I don't trust to make decisions for us. I mean, let's picture you. You're in Florida and you go to a Florida Gators football game. It's not unreasonable to speculate that you might be the smartest person in the stadium. But collectively, everyone in the packed stadium, one can hope that we get back to that kind of normalcy, would be quite a bit smarter than you, exponentially smarter than you. And what I'm describing is free markets. It's not that the former Soviet Union, it's not that Cuba today, that North Korea today doesn't have experts. Of course, it's got experts. But experts can't be smarter than the market. They can't be smarter than the broad knowledge of everyone. Yet in this case, you have someone like Fauci. Let's assume that, again, he's wildly smart. Debatable, but let's assume he is. He can't know more than 330 million Americans. And so politicians, when they talk about crises, they're talking about something that's self-fulfilling, because whenever they deem a crisis, they put the decision-making power into the hands of the very few. And so they create a crisis. What am I saying there? Central planning doesn't work. It's not that Fauci's not more knowledgeable probably than you and I about immunology and all this, but he can't be smarter than every American. And so precisely because a virus is spreading, that's when you want people to be most free. You want 330 million different Americans trying different things, approaching the virus in different ways so we can find out what is the answer. Why does the virus spread? What are the behavioral actions that are most associated with spread? Instead, we just handed the very few power to control our lives. Hence, we created a crisis.
This is a bit speculative, and I don't think it's, I wouldn't say you don't cover it in the book. You do talk about the entrepreneurial spirit, and it persists even through all kinds of government restrictions. And I get that, and I love that. But I wonder about the uncertainty now that has to hover over people's minds, especially in the hospitality industry, in entertainment. I know people, just last night I was talking to somebody who owns a small venue in Florida here, where, you know, let's say fourth tier bands might go play, but everybody loves it. It's part of the culture of that place. Everybody loves this place. And for a year, they haven't been able to do anything. You know, it's been one restriction or another. And now finally, they're starting to get some activity and they're having concerts again, but they still might not survive. So I wonder about this. In the future, does that mean fewer people are going to bother opening a restaurant in the first place? Fewer people are going to do a lot of these things in the first place? Or is there just this entrepreneurial can-do spirit that's going to somehow overcome that? I mean, I'm just asking you to speculate. I wonder.
No, it's such a good question. And I touch on it a lot in one of the later chapters, and that I make my point that awful as this was, ridiculous, anti-life as these lockdowns were, mindless as they were, this is not going to kill the entrepreneurial spirit in the U.S. because let's never forget, entrepreneurs face death every day. Phil Knight, the creator of Nike, spent the first 18 years of the company's existence thinking the next day would be Nike's last. He just, every night he would tell his wife everything's going to be okay, but he didn't really believe it. And that describes entrepreneurs in general. They constantly have near-death experiences. So for them, a bunch of idiot politicians doing as politicians do, I don't think it's going to stop the desire of entrepreneurs to try new things and figure out new ways to meet our needs. But let's never forget, as Schumpeter always said, there are no entrepreneurs without capital. And I'm sure Mises said it even more artfully. Are investors going to be as willing to commit capital to new ideas, knowing what they know now, that politicians have discovered an ability to, when they get nervous, to put massive amounts of the most dynamic economy in the world in deep freeze in very quick fashion. That's terrifying. And so what we don't know is if entrepreneurs are going to be as readily available, if investors are going to be as readily available for entrepreneurs.
Yeah, and that's what we're going to have to wait and see. Of course, it depends on also how sure we can be that this will never happen again. You know, I'd love us to triumph so decisively that nobody would dare recommend a policy like this ever again.
You hit on something so important, the question of, will this ever happen again? And that's why I make such a, well, I wouldn't say muscular case, that's presumptive, but I make such an impassioned case in the second to last chapter that we cannot make this a statistical debate. See, that's the other reason I didn't write a medical book. I mean, in addition, because I couldn't write a medical book. The statistics support our view that, oh, wow, politicians overreact. But to me, such a view, such an argument wins the near-term battle but loses the war. I mean, so what? My reaction to that is, let's say that Imperial College had predicted 10 million deaths. That calls even more for freedom. Again, really, who are, I want to meet the people who would require government force to not engage in risky behavior if the thought was that all sorts of Americans were going to die. I mean, people were going to adjust either way. But I think the statistical argument is a dangerous one because implicit there is that if something threatens us enough, politicians have the right to take our freedom, have the right to destroy business, have the right to tell us we can't go to work. No, freedom on its own is its own virtue. I would have been against the lockdowns even if you could have proven to me, which you can't, that they actually save lives. Governments just shouldn't be locking down. And so we know, history is clear, this won't be the last virus to reach us. And because it won't be, the answer has to begin and end with freedom, that politicians should not be allowed to do this. Because otherwise, the next time a virus strikes, the same experts will go to the same easily gulled politicians, different names, saying, you know, this time is different. Unless we take away freedom and wreck lives this time, that we've got a serious health problem on their hands. No, no, no. People get it. Do not take away their freedom, period.
All right. Let me, just for fun, John, just for fun, let me give you a little pushback on that. Let's make an analogy. Let's talk about the minimum wage. Now, it could be. Let's imagine that there's a world where you impose a minimum wage and there are absolutely no employment effects whatsoever. I'm still against the minimum wage. Okay. I'm against it because freedom of contract. But if I go out to the general public and I say, I think employers should be able to offer whatever wage they want and people should be able to accept it. I'll get some libertarians on board, but 97% of the public will think I'm a monster and not listen to me. So therefore, I make different arguments against the minimum wage because I'm dealing, in some cases, with children. And so I have to make arguments appropriate to children. I have to say, well, it doesn't really work because such and such. Well, likewise, I think with this, what I've seen through this thing is there are people who, if you talk about your freedom, they think you're the worst person in the world, that there are some things more important than freedom. They don't want it. There are people who frankly don't want it. So the thing that I think will work with them, even while, yes, of course I want to talk about freedom, but I want to make the arguments that work. The argument that works the best is these people don't know what the hell they're doing. That the things that they're demanding of you don't even work. So I think that matters, that we win everywhere we possibly can with the most likely to succeed arguments.
You know, that's a great point. That's the best pushback I've ever gotten on my argument. So thank you for that.
Oh, well, that makes me feel good. Thank you, John.
No, and it's true. You put it so well that to some degree, and I'm clearly one of those, we get too idealistic. But I think to some degree also we have to be idealistic. That once we go down the statistical path, and look, it's not that my book doesn't have statistics. It just, it's not chock full of them because I think there has to be a wide range of arguments. Mine is going to be that freedom is its own virtue. And I think I make a case that's better than statistics, that freedom is its own virtue, that when people are free, they produce economic growth. And I make a point in the book that that's been essential to health outcomes, that in the 19th century, if you broke your femur, you had 1 in 3 chances of death, but if you lived, you were going to get your leg amputated. In the 19th century, you had as good of a chance of dying as living when you were born. In the 19th century, you rarely died of cancer. So there was a certain killer because to be clear, pneumonia and tuberculosis got you first. What changed economic growth that produced the resources necessary to turn yesterday's killers into today's afterthoughts? And so the freedom idea works from an economic perspective. It also works from an information perspective. We learn from people doing different things, why the virus spreads and all that. But I think you make a great point. Look, I'm going to make my freedom argument, but it probably makes sense for others to make the statistical because that probably does lift some people into our camp who otherwise wouldn't be there. I remain, though, of the view that it's dangerous because once you go down that path, you're basically saying government can take our freedom anytime as long as they can create a case impressive enough that we can't be left to our own devices.
Well, my hope is that this kind of experience has, to use the expression, red-pilled a lot of people. And it has, if my email inbox is any indication. I have people who ideologically couldn't have been farther away from me, but this issue alone has caused them to rethink a lot of things they thought they knew because now they're wondering, gee, can I trust what I'm told by such and such person in authority? And that has opened up amazing vistas for them. So I'm hopeful that this experience will make some people, maybe we'll win them over on the grounds that these measures don't work. But once we've won them over on that, then they wonder, gee, what else have I been misled about? And maybe ultimately they come around to the freedom argument. You know, doggone it, screw these people. Next time, I'm not going to go for anything they say. I don't care how effective or not effective it is. It's much better for me to just live my life and make my own decision. I mean, maybe eventually, bit by bit, little by little, we get them to come around. It's like when people talk about who will build the roads, right? My approach to that is not to say, well, of course, we could crowdfund them. We could do that. I don't even do that. I say, you know what? I'll concede the roads to you. How about that? I'll concede the roads. Let's talk about everything else under the sun except the roads. And once I convince them about the other things, they come around on the roads. You know, they do. They say, well, wait a minute. I mean, just laying down long stretches of tar is probably not the most technologically confusing thing in the world. I'm sure we could figure something out. I think they come around on the bigger issues eventually.
I love it. I think that's a great way of putting it. And I think you're right. I think I find things in every instance in the world that ever happens. And certainly this, I think, probably woke a lot of people up to how quickly politicians can do major damage. And I do think there's been a change in the electorate. We maybe haven't seen it yet, but in the book's concluding chapter, I talk about those videos that were passed around on the internet. Remember when they said the internet was left for dead with the getting rid of net neutrality and all this? But those videos passed around the internet from Los Angeles. Those hopeless politicians in California said no 4th of July fireworks parades this year. None of that, none of those shows. And so what did Californians do? They gave the big middle finger to the politicians all over Los Angeles. People were having individual fireworks shows. I think there's a deep-seated freedom, fierce individualism within the American people that has been reawoken in this. And I refuse to not be optimistic about what's ahead based on that.
Well, the book is When Politicians Panicked, The New Coronavirus Expert Opinion and a Tragic Lapse of Reason by our guest, John Tammy. I'll have the book linked on our show notes page, tomwoods.com/1871. John, best of luck with it. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me on. I'm very grateful.
All right, folks, before we go, here's something you probably were not expecting to hear the old man say, but you just never know what's going to happen on the Tom Woods Show. I got a guy named Ken Madden, just like the old football announcer, John Madden, M-A-D-D-E-N, Ken Madden. And he is a car guy and a motorcycle guy, and he has been for 35 years. But what he does is he's a libertarian, so we already know he's a great guy, and he's a Tom Woods Show listener, longtime listener, so point number two in his favor. But what he does is he creates works of art related to automobiles and motorcycles. So he says, I will capture the essence of any car, truck, or motorcycle in a 16x20 portrait for only $350. So it's a wonderful thing for car and motorcycle lovers, but it's also a unique gift for such a person. You guarantee they don't have. And when you look at his work, it is stunning. His business is Mad K Studio. So M-A-D-D, the letter K for Ken, Studio. So the website is madkstudio.com, M-A-D-D-K-studio.com. I'll link to it at tomwoods.com/1871. So here's an opportunity to get a unique, irreplaceable gift for yourself or someone else while also supporting a good, hardworking libertarian. So madkstudio.com is where to go. And remember, if you're thinking of starting a website, you can get publicity from me and some other really, really great benefits that are going to help you a lot. And all you got to do is just get your web hosting through my link and you're going to get great web hosting. In fact, he says, Ken says, the Bluehost service has been absolutely spectacular for me over the last year, outstanding in every way, plus very affordable. So how do you get all these goodies from old Woods for absolutely nothing? Head over to tomwoods.com/publicity for the details. I'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.